First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Policing the police. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, an in-depth investigation into calls to remove troublesome police from local streets. We'll go to your calls on this in a bit. It's 549-2937. Then later, renewed calls for gun reform after yet another school shooting, the 27th in America this year. We'll speak with former Florida Congresswoman Debbie Mercozzle-Powell, now a senior advisor at the gun reform advocacy group, Giffords. That's all ahead, but first this hour, an investigation into problem police officers at JSO. Now, last fall, First Coast News began investigating the fact that two officers on the state attorney's Brady list of problematic cops, police with criminal records and credibility issues, were still walking the beat, still working at JSO. So what has happened since? Well, there's a lot to discuss. We're pleased to welcome Ann Schindler, executive producer with special projects at First Coast News. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Also on the line, Jude Facciadomo, president of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Hi, Jude.
Good morning, Melissa.
And it's 549-2937 as we talk about this First Coast News investigation. What are your questions? 549-2937. Later, we'll hear about how JSO tried to charge an $87,000 for a public records request at the police station. That's later. But first, let's talk about this big investigation. And let's begin with you. Last fall, you at First Coast News began investigating that two officers on state attorney Melissa Nelson's so-called Brady list were still working. Can you begin by explaining what is the Brady list?
Sure. Thanks, Melissa. The Brady list is basically a list that the state attorney's office keeps volitionally. She's not required to keep this list. And in fact, her predecessor, Angela Corey, did not maintain a list. But basically, it's a list of officers, like you said, that have some sort of issue that needs to be disclosed to defendants in cases in which they might be a witness. And that could be that the officer has got a prior arrest or the officer has some sort of credibility issue. There's, you know, several dozen people on this list that have to be disclosed, but most of them have quit or been fired. And what we learned was that there were two still employed by JSO. So we were looking into, you know, why that was and what their background was. And one of them has, you know, a relatively sort of minor seeming issue, which is a DUI from several years ago. But the other is on the list because of credibility concerns, specifically a judicial order, essentially, or a judicial statement in a case that dismissed a criminal case based on this particular officer's lack of credibility. And he wrote a multi-page order laying out why this officer, Sergeant John Nobles, he goes by J.C. Nobles, was not credible, that he was evasive and that his testimony could not be relied on and that he completely changed his testimony between his deposition and this suppression hearing, and therefore he was throwing out all the evidence in this criminal case. There were two defendants. Both cases were dropped because this officer couldn't be credible. And so because of that judge's order, that rather extraordinary order, the state attorney put him on their Brady list.
And then what happened?
Well, this officer in the Fraternal Order of Police have long contended he didn't belong on the list, that he had simply gotten confused, that his deposition was incorrect. And even though he didn't try to correct it, even though he knew, he says, that it was wrong for a year, you know, that he just made a mistake and he shouldn't be on the Brady list because he wasn't deliberately deceiving anybody. They have been lobbying the state attorney for some time. And after we did our story, again, appealed to the state attorney to take him off the Brady list. And the state attorney did something really unusual. They sent a letter to the judge in this four-year-old closed case asking him for clarity on his order, saying, you know, we've got him on the Brady list. We need to know if you really thought he was lying. And the judge did something extraordinary himself. He didn't refuse to answer the order. Most judges, I think, would just say this case is, you know, I have no jurisdiction over a closed case. I mean, there's no no proper way to kind of weigh in. But what he did is he denied the order and at the same time offered this explanation as to why he didn't think that this officer belonged on the list. He didn't actually think he had lied or had not intended his order to apply beyond that specific case. So he issued this opinion. The state attorney's office took the officer off the Brady list, and that's kind of where we are right now.
And that's where it stands now. 549-2937. Let's go now to Jude Facciadomo, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. What's been your reaction to this turn of events?
Well, a little bit of shock, to be honest with you. First, I want to commend Ann on her reporting. You know, as criminal defense lawyers, we sometimes feel like we're screaming into a vacuum, and that's why it's so important to have free and fair press to bring these issues to light and make the public aware of them. I think it's important to understand, without getting too far into the weeds, as to what Brady is. But Brady v. Maryland is a seminal United States Supreme Court case, which essentially is designed to level the playing field. Despite constitutional protections, any defendant facing the full force of the state or the government is in a very serious situation. All the money and resources lined up against them. And Brady was essentially the Supreme Court's decision that said this needs to be fair and you can't conceal evidence. In fact, you have a proactive obligation to disclose to the defense when there's an issue, one such issue being evidence that materially impeaches any fact or witness, which is Sergeant Noble's in this case, based upon Judge Anderson's order. So it was commendable, certainly, that Ms. Nelson kept a list, but Ann's 100% correct that that's not an obligation by her office. But that gets a little confused because the list is a function of the obligation. Any state attorney who's prosecuting a case has an obligation to disclose this evidence. Whether you keep a list or not is irrelevant. You could shred the list, the obligation still exists. So our position here is that all of this information, including the fact that Sergeant Nobles was found not to be credible, the fact that the state attorney's office acted on his behalf and filed a motion with the court on a case that had long since been closed and where there was no jurisdiction, that the judge issued a very curious order, as Ann pointed out, and that it's now become a focus of a great deal of media attention, that all needs to be disclosed under the Brady obligation. And our position is it compels more transparency, not less. And the fact that the state attorney's office is now saying, we're taking him off the list, let's distill that down. What does that really mean? It means we will no longer disclose this to defense attorneys, which to us screams of an attempt to conceal something that may be materially relevant and flies in the face of Brady. One other point to know about the Brady obligation is back in 2016, the Florida Bar found it to be such an issue that they codified a rule of criminal procedure that requires all attorneys involved in criminal practice, including defense attorneys, which I think they did that just to make it seem fair, but defense attorneys have no Brady obligation, only prosecutors do. But they codified a rule saying that all criminal practitioners need to do at least 100 hours of Brady training so that they know what their obligation is and they know what they have to turn over. So it's all very troubling how this is playing out.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Ann Schindler of First Coast News and Jude Facciadomo, president of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, calling in from Miami this morning about a First Coast News investigation into why the state attorney has taken an officer with a questionable record off the Brady list. as we've been hearing that defined just now on the show. What are your questions? 549-2937, Biko in Jacksonville. Hi, Biko. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure, go ahead.
Yes, the thing that I'm seeing is the pattern from Angela Corey all the way down to Melissa Nelson is the level of transparency have not changed yet. You know, we have spoken about J.C. Nobles on multiple occasions to the public. A lot of our community members know and are aware of the doings or the wrongdoings and the corruption of this officer. And my question is, why does he continue to be rewarded to all the way to a sergeant position?
Thank you, Biko. Ann Schindler, First Coast News. You know, Melissa Nelson was elected pledging to bring more transparency and accountability to the state attorney's office after the controversial tenure of her predecessor, Angela Corey. By most accounts, she has done that. She has instituted a series of reforms. She's been proactive in talking about what the office is doing. She's embraced smart justice concepts, civil citations for juveniles, other things. What's her response to this investigation? What is she telling you?
Well, she has written a letter, and I interviewed her chief assistant, Lee Hutton, about this. You know, their contention is that it wasn't clear, that the judge's order was not manifestly clear. I'm not sure. I mean, evidently it wasn't clear because the judge now has come out with this order clarifying that seems to contravene what he said in his original order. But I will say that the reason that he landed on the Brady list, you know, and the reason that I think most people read that order the way they did is because it's pretty emphatically clear what the judge is saying. It doesn't seem ambiguous. He said he found Nobles, quote, specifically not credible. He said the sergeant, quote, did not seem to have an accurate memory, was evasive, confrontational, argumentative, and non-responsive during cross-examination. And he said that Nobles, quote, completely and materially changed his sworn testimony. So it's pretty clear that the judge is saying that this officer was not reliable. And I you know, whether you're going to say, is he a liar, is he not a liar, I guess that's open to interpretation. Clearly the judge has kind of reversed his original inference, I guess you will. You know, but the state attorney has provided this list. It's a public record that did not exist under her predecessor, which I think is worth noting. But, you know, the issue of transparency writ large, you know, I think that Biko, who's an activist in the community who just called, talking about this specific officer, you know, there is something happening on a tandem track right now in terms of transparency, the lack thereof. This officer actually has more officer-involved shootings than any other current officer on working at JSO. And that's a fact that you can
how
no
many?
Longer...
How many?
Well, for some reason, they categorized one of his initial shootings as two. I don't know if it's because two people were involved, but so it's either four or five. But basically, there was four individuals shot. And that fact you can no longer find on any JSO website or through any public information request because our local Fraternal Order of Police filed suit to seek a designation of officers involved in officer-involved shootings as victims under Marcy's Law. And they won. And now any officer involved in any sort of basically altercation, certainly any shooting, is categorized as a victim and their information is redacted. And so we no longer know who is involved in officer-involved shootings. We no longer know who has the most shootings. We no longer know anything about the officers involved in these incidents. And that is really appalling lack of transparency.
So Jude Facciadomo, will there be an appeal to this decision? What will your organization do?
Yeah, so let me speak to that. But I also like to address your question to Anne, if I may, Melissa, about the state attorney's position as to this. So I did have an opportunity to speak with Ms. Nelson, and let me say this. I do commend her for taking the time to speak with representatives of the criminal defense bar. We ultimately disagree on how to proceed, but at least there was an open dialogue. So that's something redeemable, certainly. The problem here is that her office reviewed this and then made their own interpretation, which led to the filing of this motion. That is not the guidance under what is required by Brady. They are the gatekeepers of the information. They are required to disclose it. Theirs is not to interpret whether it is beneficial or whether the judgment A or whether the judgment B. And this goes to your caller's previous point that the issue here is one of transparency, and it's one of transparency not just to the general public and to the people of Jacksonville that the state attorney represents, but to the defendants and to the very serious business of a criminal prosecution. To your question as to where it stands now, the trial lawyer, Anthony Rossetti, who did an outstanding job and is a member of our organization, filed a, well, it's important to note first, he requested time to respond to the state's motion, first asking that it be summarily denied because it was out of time. It was untimely. There was no jurisdiction for the court to issue the order that it did. I mean, it ultimately denied it, but and he was not given that time, which is a pretty standard request. He didn't have an opportunity to file a response at the trial court. He filed a motion to vacate Judge Anderson's order, clarifying that was denied. It is now, he's filed a notice of appeal. Our organization, the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, will be assisting him and will be filing an amicus brief at the appellate court on the denial of the order vacating. So that's where we stand as far as the litigation is concerned. As far as more in a granular level at the trial court, so we've been encouraging all of our members to raise this issue on any case that Sergeant Nobles is a witness on. We're also encouraging our members to ask the trial court to inquire of the prosecutors assigned to each case prior to trial whether they have completed their Brady obligation under Rule 3.113. And now a new issue that's arisen and that we've written to State Attorney Nelson as recently as yesterday about is we believe that the state attorney's office has now acted as Sergeant Nobles' attorney because they filed a motion at his behest and on his behalf seeking the very relief that he wanted. They are now his lawyer. They cannot prosecute a case where he is a witness because under the professional code of conduct, they now have a conflict of interest. So we believe their office needs to recuse itself and bring in a special assigned prosecutor from out of jurisdiction on any case that Sergeant Nobles is on.
Let me ask a follow-up question. It's sort of a related issue. Ann Schindler, First Coast News, you made news recently when JSO sent you a bill for $87,000 and change. When you made what amounted to, it seemed to me anyway, a pretty routine public records request. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, that was actually an outgrowth of this story. I mean, just because it was everything about it was so unusual, we wanted to find out, you know, if there had been any communications, sort of what had been the dialogue among the various, you know, the courts and the state attorney's office and the officers. So we did a public records request that was basically for like a dozen email addresses, including, you know, people from the FOP and the court, and five or six key word searches or term searches over a period of a couple of years. And they sent back, well, initially they said, do you want to, you know, reduce this? It's going to be 71,000 emails that we have to go through and redact. And I said, well, let's get the estimate first. And just them asking, I realized it was going to be massively expensive. I was thinking, gosh, this is going to be like $600 or $800. So when I got the $87,401 invoice, I was like surprised. But I did then try to reduce the request by some 60,000 emails, you know, and reduced my request by about 96%. And they offered me a new estimate of 11,000 and some change.
And so, okay. And you haven't paid that, I assume.
No, we're still trying to figure out a way to narrow that request down.
Will you consider litigation over this? You know, after we first aired this story, a panelist on our Friday show here, attorney and former Jacksonville City Council President Jack Webb, contacted me and said he'd be willing to represent First Coast News in litigating this matter.
Well, you know, I do think that there is a potential for, you know, at least a legal, you know, I know that sometimes when our First Amendment lawyers get involved in something like this, they are helpful in, you know, kind of the back and forth. I think part of the problem that, you know, what I think should have happened and probably would have happened with another agency is, you know, when a request comes back and it's this high, you know, a proactive, you know, agent of that office can call the reporter and be like, hey, you know, this is really high. Let's see how we can reduce this. The back and forth through the public records portal is very cumbersome. And so, you know, most recently I asked if they could take out all forwarded emails or attachments. And they said, no, they couldn't do that. And so I kind of said, well, can't you do like a search for just FW in the subject line and remove those, like a forwarded email? And that was, you know, they said they'd look into that, and that was a week ago. So the back and forth is kind of, you know, it's cumbersome. It's time consuming. It's not that we can't get the records request down, but it's not, I'm not really talking directly to a person. I'm kind of emailing or sending requests through this cumbersome portal. So I think that that's part of the issue. I do think that, you know, an attorney might be one-on-one speaking to like the general counsel, probably could get more done than I'm getting done right now back and forth with the public records officer.
Well, keep us posted. In the meantime, I want to thank you both for your information we provided to our listeners today on this important story. Ann Schindler, First Coast News, Jude Facciodomo, president of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Melissa.
And much more still ahead. Coming up, the Jacksonville Symphony holds its first ever Pride Night. And guess what? We've got a ticket giveaway, so keep listening for that. That's later, but up next.
I lost my father to gun violence when I was 24 years old. And every time that you see these shootings, these massacres, it really triggers the trauma.
Renewed calls again for gun reform in America after another horrific school shooting. We'll be right back. Well, there have been 27 school shootings in America so far this year. We're not even halfway through the year yet. The latest one, you might have heard, happened in Texas yesterday, killing 19 elementary school students and two teachers. The mass shooting came right on the heels of another one at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, also featuring an 18-year-old shooter with an assault weapon. That one targeted African Americans. Now, in response to the Texas shooting this week, Duval County Public Schools has announced they've revised their policy on the types of bags students can bring to school. 90% of Americans say they support common sense reforms to make us safer and protect kids and adults from gun violence, things like universal background checks. Yet the Senate refuses to act. In the wake of the Buffalo shooting and before the Texas shooting happened, I spoke with former U.S. Representative Debbie Mercastle-Powell of South Florida. She is now a senior advisor at Giffords. Giffords advocates for gun reform. It was founded by Gabby Giffords, a former member of Congress who herself was shot during an assassination attempt. Here's that conversation. Representative, it's good to be with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me.
So as I mentioned, since leaving Congress, you're now a senior advisor at Giffords. When you sat in Congress, you were on the Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, Homeland Security. You served as the vice chair of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force in Congress and led on passing the first gun safety legislation in more than two decades. And so In the wake of Buffalo, what are your thoughts, first off, about Congress's inaction on the problem of gun violence in this country?
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. Look, I've been working on this issue, like you said, for many years. I lost my father to gun violence when I was 24 years old. And every time that you see these shootings, these massacres, really from Buffalo to Pulse to El Paso, it really, it triggers the trauma. And I speak not only for me, I've become very close with so many parents that have lost their children at Parkland, with so many families here in Florida that have lost their children to senseless gun violence. It really does become a traumatic event once again for all of us who know that feeling. And when I saw what happened in Buffalo, it was extremely frustrating. And understanding that we know that there are things that we can do at the federal level that can prevent these type of violent acts. When I was in Congress, the positive thing is that because we had a majority of gun safety advocates that were elected in 2018, we were able to pass a universal background check bill, and it got stalled in the Senate. Well, now we have a Senate that's evenly split 50-50, and the rules are that you need at least 60 votes to pass any sort of meaningful legislation. Well, that's not working. And the reason why I bring that up is because when you have 90% of Americans, whether Republicans, Independents, or Democrats, 90% that support that bill, that support a thorough background check for anyone that wants to purchase a weapon, and yet it gets stalled because of an archaic rule in the Senate, something is just not right. And I'm being very strong on this issue because we can't continue to wake up to news of another community being left behind with this hateful crime. Now, this particular incident in Buffalo is being investigated as a hate crime. And we also have to look at what is happening in our country, where there's so much hatred, division, where there's a rise of white supremacy, and many people in power refuse to condemn it. So there are a lot of things that we need to address, and it really is a moment for Americans to raise their voices and ensure that they put pressure on people that are representing them to take action.
Now, you advise Giffords, an organization dedicated to saving lives from gun violence. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, we know her story. She founded this organization. She herself was shot at a constituent event in her home state. And so tell us more about what Giffords is doing, if you could, when it comes to this issue.
You know, Giffords has done so much over the past 10 years after Gabby really used this moment in her life. Instead of retreating, she actually decided, I'm moving forward. I'm going to make a difference here, whether I'm in Congress or not, whether I have this disability after being shot or not. And I have to say, she's been an inspiration for so many of us. I actually joined Giffords because it was the gun violence prevention group that was active in Congress while I was serving Florida's 26th district. They work not only at the federal level, Melissa, to not only educate members who are interested in this issue and trying to advocate for gun safety, but they also work directly with states all over the country, with the legislatures, to ensure not only that they stop really terrible gun bills from being passed, but also to encourage different state legislatures and different state governors to address this issue, to educate their constituencies so that they can actually pass meaningful gun safety reforms. One of the things that we just saw after having a lot of conversations with the governor from Illinois is that he just passed legislation to stop the sales of any ghost guns that are being sold in the state of Chicago. That's the type of work that we engage in. We also bring awareness and educate different communities. One of the things that I'm doing personally is ensuring that we communicate directly with our Hispanic communities who are vastly affected by gun violence, yet no one really talks about that. And it's important for our Hispanic communities to understand that they do have a voice on this issue, that we understand what is happening when kids are going outside of their homes and are being shot right in their neighborhoods, and how we can address that. Another thing is advocating for more investments on community prevention programs. And it's one of the things that actually, when Gabby was down here in Florida, we went to visit with the Circle of Brotherhood, and the Giffords organization is providing a grant to the Circle of Brotherhood for all the work that they're doing in community violence prevention program here in Miami.
Now, speaking of Florida, your reaction to Governor DeSantis saying he wants lawmakers to send him legislation that would allow the open carry of guns in the Sunshine State without any kind of license or permit.
Melissa, it's not only extremely reckless by this governor to even attempt to discuss this bill, but it is so dangerous for every Floridian living here. I can honestly tell you, I've had so many conversations with people from all sides of the political spectrum. No one in Florida wants to walk out to a Starbucks and find people with an AR-15 fully armed without a permit or any sort of firearm being carried openly without a permit. This is exactly what this bill does. Make no mistake, the more guns that are in the streets, the more incidents of violence and homicide, the more incidents that will result in death. Because if you have an altercation with someone at a store, if you're having a bad day in your car, and now you're empowered by a governor who's saying, yes, go ahead and carry your arm loaded without any sort of permit, we know what can happen. It can have devastating results. As parents, I have two school-aged kids. We've seen what happens when criminals enter schools with an AR-15 and kill a large amount of people in a very short period of time. Now you're saying that our children are going to be out in their community and they're going to see people openly carrying loaded firearms without a permit. In what society does this make sense? This is only for the profit of the gun lobby. This is only to incite a very radicalized base. We have seen the results of this type of incitement. Buffalo, a clear example of that. We are seeing how words and bills and having these people in power talk about guns as though it is a God-given right, when the God-given right is to life. It's the most hypocritical thing coming from a party that is now trying to control, and not to get into this issue, but really to control other people's choices, right? So at this point, I can say that Floridians are not going to allow this to happen. There are thousands and thousands of voices in the state that will stand up to that.
Can we be clear in stating that Giffords supports the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms? What you advocate for, is my understanding, is gun safety, stronger laws around gun safety. Can you explain the specifics of that?
Absolutely. And yes, actually, I don't know if many people know this, but Gabby owns a gun. She's a gun owner, and her husband, Senator Mark Kelly, as well. What they advocate for is exactly what you said. It's safety around firearms. We know that there's a huge number of incidents of children who have access to firearms at home that are not safely stored, and then it results in really tragic accidents. So we advocate for people who have firearms in their homes to have them safely stored and locked. We advocate for laws like the Extreme Risk Protection Law, that if you suspect that someone's going to harm themselves or others, that you can report that so that those firearms are taken temporarily from that person. There's actually, we have about 100,000 people that have joined the Giffords group that are actually gun owners who have said, you know, the NRA does not speak for me. I want responsible gun ownership. I don't want people that have violent backgrounds, that have been accused of hate crimes, to be able to have easy access to a firearm. So this is about responsible gun ownership. It has absolutely nothing to do with the Constitution, right? We absolutely respect the Constitution and safe ownership of arms and responsible gun ownership. We're talking about how do we pass laws that really protect the overall safety of our communities.
I want to thank you. Former member of Congress Debbie Mercazel-Powell was elected to Florida's 26th congressional district, and she's now a senior advisor to Giffords. Giffords.org for more. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, the Jacksonville Symphony is making its grand finale for its Symphony in 60 series of the current season with its first ever celebration of Pride Night. It's coming up tomorrow evening. Tony Nickel is Symphony Vice President and Artistic Administrator and joins us now in studio. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So this is your first time doing this. Why'd you decide to do it?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of organizations, arts organizations, for-profits, are really focusing on diversity and being inclusive to everyone. And we do believe we're the symphony for everyone in Jacksonville. And it's long overdue to celebrate the LGBTQ community. And it's nearly June and our season is nearly over. So this is a great opportunity. And this is a very important issue to music director Courtney Lewis, who was on the Jasmine board. A few years back. So it's
so
long
you're
overdue.
Doing it. June is Pride Month. You will have a beneficiary for tomorrow night's performance. It's Jasmine.
Yep.
They work with LGBTQ kids in the community.
Yeah, it's a wonderful organization, and we'll be having a 50-50 raffle benefiting Jasmine.
Okay, so tell us about Symphony in 60.
Well, it's a series that Courtney Lewis inspired when he came to the Jacksonville Symphony as music director. And it's really geared toward a specific goal of introducing symphonic music in a little bit of a different way than one typically sees when they go to a concert. And there are a few different components. We have just one, about a 1 hour concert without any intermission. And the conductor tends to talk a little bit more about what you're going to hear and maybe some ways to listen to it in different ways. That makes it really accessible to the audiences. And then we have a large screen over the stage that is showing live video action of the musicians on the stage and the conductor. So all of that together brings a fresh concert experience that's really great if you for people who have never been going to concerts before,
mm-hmm.
or if you're a regular concert goer and just want to see it in a little bit of a different way. So it's just a very unique experience in that way. And we have five Symphony in 60s throughout the course of the season. And this is the last one of this 21-22
last
season.
Last one of the season.
Yeah.
And what will be performed?
We're going to be performing Tchaikovsky's Fantasy Overture from Romeo and Juliet. And that's actually significant because, you know, one, it's a love story, and it's a star-crossed but sort of doomed, difficult love story. And what's really interesting and poignant about this on Pride Night is that Tchaikovsky, scholars know now after being suppressed for decades under the Soviet Union regime, Tchaikovsky was gay and had many secret lovers. Some were pupils, some were actually distant relatives, but he wrote this overture inspired by one of these loves that he had. And of course, at the time in Tsarist Russia, that was absolutely not possible to be public about. It was very dangerous to do so. So it's really, you know, this impossible love, it was a great metaphor for the struggles that he himself faced. And then we're going to be concluding the concert with a clarinet concerto by Mozart. And we're going to be featuring our principal clarinetist, Giovanni Bertoni, who is an amazing clarinetist. We're very lucky to have with the symphony. And this is a piece that we had scheduled last year, but because of so many of the COVID regulations everyone on stage was playing in masks, including our winds and brass. It was just not really possible to do this piece in that iteration. So that's going to be a really exciting way to wrap the concert up.
Nice. And then a few more shows after tonight before you go dark for the summer, right?
Yeah, two more weekends. Both are part of our really big subscription series. Next weekend, we're doing The Music of Queen, which is going to feature...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I know. It features a front band, a really incredible front singer who does the Freddie Mercury. And it's not really meant to be a tribute where they try to sound exactly like Queen, but man, his voice is just as flexible as Freddie Mercury's was. And, you know, they're playing with the symphony. So that'll be a really excellent way to wrap up our Pops series. And then our last weekend, June 10th and 11th, is going to feature both Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, epic piece that, you know, is maybe the greatest and most recognizable piece in the repertoire, and a piece that we commissioned by a British-American composer named Tarik O'Regan. And this is the first of a series of commissions that we're going to be doing over the next several years, with the goal of, you know, the Jacksonville Symphony being at the core of orchestras around the United States that is putting new music into the repertoire that can have a life and get performed again and again. So it's going to be a really exciting evening of one of everyone's favorites and something new.
Fantastic. So folks, here's the moment you've been waiting for. We are giving away two pairs of tickets to the Jacksonville Symphony's grand finale for its Symphony in 60 series. It's the last Symphony in 60 performance of the season tomorrow night, and it's also the symphony's first ever celebration of Pride Night with a raffle benefiting Jasmine. Do you want a pair of tickets to go see Symphony in 60 tomorrow night? Here's the deal. Email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and put Symphony in the subject line. We will pick two winners at random. Send those emails and check out the full slate of incredible concerts at jackssymphony.org. If you can't make it to Symphony in 60, as we just heard from Tony, there are two more performances before the summer. Again, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and put Symphony in the subject to enter our giveaway. Tony Nickel, Vice President and Artistic Administrator at the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
I know it'll be a great show. A quick break, and when we come back, everything from a new lead at the Pace Center for Girls to a new ecotourism company getting you outside here on the First Coast, and a lot more. It's our roundup of a little good news for your Wednesday. That's next. We'll be right back.
How climate change is affecting St. Augustine and how artists are using their work to push for solutions. Join ADAPT and Flagler College for Undercurrents, Cultures of Climate Change, a conversation with local officials, subject matter experts, artists, and students. This free event is on Thursday, June 2nd in St. Augustine. Reserve your seat now at wjct.org/events.
On the independent 89.9 HT4, we've always got jazz in rotation. But this week, we're digging in deep on the shape of jazz right now and the shape of jazz to come. Tune in to the independent on 89.9 HT4, the WJCT app, or at jacksmusic.org all week to hear a song by a contemporary jazz artist every hour.
They told me put my hands up behind my head.
I'm Scott Tong. How to deal with risk? We all ask that question. Well, in a new book, retired Admiral James Stavridis offers case studies from naval history that may be instructive.
So often, in a moment of crisis, people lock into a certain course of action, you've got to be flexible. You've got to be able to adapt.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, poet Diana Getch talks about transitioning to living as a woman when she was in her late 40s. We'll also talk about what it was like to grow up trans in a time when she didn't have the language, literature, or subculture to help her understand what it meant to be trans. Her new memoir is called This Body I Wore. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The news nowadays is a bit like our weather, much more extreme. The headlines that grab the most attention generate a lot of heat and not much light. On 1A, we rely on your questions and stories to help us better understand the issues that demand more than a few tweets. With your help, we'll get to the heart of the story together.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, as we observe Mental Health Awareness Month this May, girls and young women who are struggling need special support. Ripple effects of the pandemic include economic troubles, isolation, and health problems. They're all compounding issues that girls were already struggling with while navigating their social lives, their schooling, changes in their bodies. And when these challenges are coupled with barriers to access, girls are left with limited places to turn. The PACE Center for Girls has built a nationally recognized model designed to meet girls where they are, both physically and developmentally. PACE Jacksonville proudly announces the appointment of Chantel Miles as their new executive director. I spoke with her.
We provide academic support, but we also provide mental health support. We also have a REACH program that provides support to girls in the community, specifically regarding mental health. We know that girls are relational. Girls thrive when they are privy to strong relationships, healthy relationships with their peers and definitely with the adults in their life. Unfortunately, a lot of our girls don't have that outside of the center. So at PACE, we make sure that we focus on building those healthy relationships with the girls, and we use those relationships to help them advance their academics and also with their social services needs. We're also trauma-informed, knowing that the majority of our girls have experienced some type of trauma in their life, and that trauma is driving their behavior. So one of the benefits of COVID, if there were any benefits, is that we were able to use the time that we were working remotely to totally revamp the center and do a remodel. So we have an open house for community partners to come and see the building, see the wonderful changes that have been made, and really get a good grasp of the work that we do inside the center.
So with all of that said, come on out to the PACE Center for Girls open house. It's tonight at 6 o'clock. Meet their new executive director, Chantel Miles. They are located at 2933 University Boulevard North. And here's some more good news for your Wednesday. Jacksonville author Julie Delegal is pleased to announce her first novel, Seen, has earned the gold medal for best fiction in the Southeast region from the 2022 Independent Publisher Book Awards. Inspired by true events in this city more than 20 years ago, Scene tells the story of a good kid, a good cop, and a disastrous mistake. Delegal published Scene under her own imprint last summer. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at local independent booksellers like San Marco Books and Chamblin's. It was also named a quarterfinalist in the 2019 Screencraft Cinematic Book Contest in the unpublished category. Congrats to Julie Delegal. Well, the Women's Giving Alliance has announced $660,000 in grants to 17 local nonprofits. More than 150 members of the Alliance gathered at UNF's University Center to celebrate this year's grant recipients. Through strategic collective giving, the WGA was able to award its largest grant distribution in the organization's 20-year history. Amazing. Well, here's something cool. Earth Kinship, a new local company that gets you outdoors and learning about the natural world. Earth Kinship offers ecotourism outings like kayak tours and even overnight trips. Those are coming soon. Plus naturalist classes.
I spoke with Iolani Haleski, owner and lead guide.
Ecotourism, what I offer, you know, starts with kayak trips. So I have a bunch of places, over 20 different locations that I'll explore the waterways of Florida. I actually believe that if you really want to explore, especially Northeast Florida with all the development, and you really want to get a wilderness feeling, going through the waterways is how to do it. But I also do hikes, and I do different things like wild foraging, a lot of different skills and naturalist skills. So I'm going to actually produce some family and adult and children programs in 2023 where we're doing a lot of naturalist studies. I think it's a good time no matter what, like all throughout the year, all throughout your life, to have a connection with the natural world. So I really believe in having that heart connection to the natural world, which is extremely important nowadays, especially with the high levels of stress that we're moving through and, you know, all the development and all the different things online. You need to unplug a little bit and get outside. Spending outside time or just being quiet for 10 minutes outside reduces your cortisol level, which we all know that the chemical that's created when we're in a high stress environment. I am a master naturalist instructor, and I used to be the naturalist for St. John's County Parks and Rec. I have created many different types of naturalist programs, and for Earth Kinship, I'm doing a one-of-a-kind naturalist program, which will basically go through four different levels or four different areas of study. So we're definitely going to be studying the mammals of Florida. We'll study birds of Florida. We're going to study different habitats of Florida and also the plants, you know, plants and trees of Florida. So this would be a good way to balance your art and science together to kind of come to be one, and also have a greater understanding of what's in your backyard and what's in your surrounding communities.
Check it out at earthkinship.us and have fun. And thanks for listening. That's our show. Thanks to our whole team, Heather Schatz, Josh Torres, Catherine Hobbs, Jessica Palumbo, Randy Roguski, and the entire WJCT News team. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.